This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Grant and Danny welcoming you back on this Wednesday. It's July 6th, and we are happy to have you with us until 6:30 this evening ahead of Nationals pregame. Charlie Slows, Dave Jagler. First pitch tonight in Philadelphia scheduled for just after 7 o'clock. We got to welcome in our Richmond audience for the first time today on 910 AM, 105.1 FM. They're with us for the next 3 hours. If you have been enjoying the show on 106.7 The Fan for the last hour, thanks much for listening to the flagship. Remember, wherever you go in this fine country, you can listen to us on the Odyssey app coast to coast. I'll be headed out to Los Angeles for the All-Star festivities a little bit later this month, and I'll be listening to the station on the Odyssey app. Right now, let's go to the BetQL guest hotline. Bet smarter to beat the books. Download the BetQL app today. Visit BetQL.com. We're joined by ESPN's John Keim to discuss today's Terry McLaurin press conference in Ashburn. John, did you ever think at any point this offseason that this deal wasn't going to come to fruition?
The timetable, Grant, that I always heard was late spring, early summer, and I never got a sense that it would go astray, right? So I always felt it would get done. I think there was a point in time where my optimism level, which had usually been about an 8, dropped to like a 7.5, because you things start to get a little bit not dicey, but maybe it wasn't as far along as I thought it was. And then toward the end of minicamp, I heard that like it was close. And there was even a point where they thought maybe he'll even come into the last day of minicamp. I think that was highly optimistic, but the point is it got closer again. And then from that point, I was like, you know, it's going to happen. So he was a must signing. I think both sides knew it, and they got it done.
Was there any point that kind of got this kickstarted? And what I mean, John, is publicly Ron Rivera was going, oh, we got it. We did Jonathan Allen last year. I was like, well, you also told me every day that Curtis Samuel was about to play, and then he rode the stationary bike, you know, and you also told me there'd be a quarterback competition, and you told me about the kicker position, and none of the things worked out like you said. So there was skepticism among some. My hand's up here. I was dead wrong. They were right. But I felt like maybe there was an escalation. When he wasn't at minicamp, I all of a sudden thought maybe something was not necessarily lighting a fire here, but maybe adding to the urgency. I feel like there was a turning point that got this thing sort of moving in earnest. Is that accurate, or am I just kind of making that up?
I do think that the talks picked up around that time. And, you know, so it may have been several days or a week before minicamp that they had started to have more communication, but it wasn't like the optimism was flowing on both sides that, hey, we're close, right? But then I know that Ron Rivera called him and reiterated, not so much to negotiate with him, but to reiterate the importance that McLaurin played to the organization, or that he had in the organization. And I think stuff like that probably always helps. Now, of course, it helps even more if it's followed by a really good offer. So I do think that the urgency became greater at that time. And whether or not it was because McLaurin wasn't showing up, or it was just a natural timetable, you know, I think that certainly things picked up around that time. And, you know, again, like I know Rivera had communication with him a couple times during that. And, you know, but even that said, the money still has to be there. The deal still has to be right. And what you knew is that McLaurin is as much a team guy as anyone you're going to cover. And he's as much a guy who's about the grind, about the journey, about being out there with his guys. So for him not to be there was very, very difficult. But I think it also showed his faith in his agent, Buddy Baker, and the resolve that he had to get the right deal for him. So I think all that stuff probably plays a factor. And it certainly signals that while he wants to be here, it still has to be for the right situation or the right price. And they got it done.
John Keim covers the Commanders for ESPN.com. You can check out his work there. And if you've been following this team for any amount of time in town, you know all about John's work on the beat over the years. How about the press conference today? I mean, anybody who goes, why do you love McLaurin so much? Why are you so enamored with the person that he is? I mean, what a home run he hit. And it's just an embodiment of a pro. Like, that's what this guy is. He's 26 going on 45. He'd be successful in any field. He could run any company that I would ever want to invest in. I thought he kind of put on a clinic today. What'd you make of what he had to say in his reintroduction to DC, I suppose?
I couldn't agree more. In fact, I was talking to Darren Haynes from Channel 9 afterwards about this. When Terry came in as a rookie, first of all, you know I'm an Ohio State guy. So I followed his career at Ohio State, and at Ohio State, he wasn't a great player. I mean, he was not a great receiver. He was a good player on a really good team. But you knew about the culture changer that he could be, right? You knew about the leadership and all that. And he's one of the few guys where you meet him, you say, he's exactly like what I heard about. All the good stuff you say. And when you first start talking to him, you're like, this guy's like a 10-year vet, the way he talks. And, you know, so there was just always something different with him. And we were talking about today, like, to me, he's almost like Derek Jeter, who's more quotable, where he's always going to say the right thing. I just think that McLaurin gives you more depth. And he's somebody who could go on for 2 minutes about any topic and give you something good without controversy for himself or anybody else. He's such a good face for the organization. So, and then I think the other part that jumped out to me, GP, when Darren Haynes asked him about what the contract meant to him, and you could tell that it was choking him up. He had to, like, the tears weren't coming, but he did admit that he had cried when he got the deal. But you could tell in his answer how much it meant to him because, again, he is about the grind, the journey. This is not a guy who assumed that he would be making this kind of money because, like, oh, I'm a great player. I'm always going to get that. He's never assumed that. I mean, he came in as a guy he thought would be special teams, backup receiver. Here he is now signing 3 years, $71 million. So I don't think he took that for granted. And I think because he knew how hard he worked to get here, and he knew what his parents did to help him or the example they showed. So all that stuff starts coming up, and you could see that it was a little bit difficult for him to talk about some of that because that's just who he is, you know. This is a guy, I apologize for rambling on about him, but there was a video that came out, and it was a reminder. I mean, we all know heard this story about how he went to an Ohio State camp when he was a senior, and Urban Meyer basically didn't want to offer him. He's like, come back in a week or whatever. So in that week, he goes and works on the jugging machine, catches a few hundred balls a day, and he comes back and he's better. He's not great, but he's better, and he gets a scholarship. But it was more the mindset that he shows there. And the other one is that when he was a rookie, minicamp, he goes out there, he's going against Dominic Rogers, Cromartie, some other veteran corners, and he's running routes that look crisp, but he's not getting open. And I'm like, and it seemed like the corners were anticipating everything he was going to do. So he even, and I even talked to him about this kind of off to the side today a little bit, but like he said that the corners would talk to him about what he wasn't doing or what he needed to do. In the 6 weeks after minicamp and before training camp, he worked on all that. He worked on changing his pace and the speed of the routes and how he ran it. He comes into training camp and just starts killing guys. That's when you know you've got a special guy.
John Keim with us here on G&D. So, John, he's not a one-man band anymore. You finally have some weapons around him where defensive coordinators have to account for other guys. First-round pick Jahan Dotson, a knock on wood, presumably healthy Curtis Samuel, and a quarterback that's got plenty of arm strength for everybody. What kind of year do you anticipate him having?
You would think he'd have a really good year. McLaurin has played with 8 different starting quarterbacks in his first 3 years. It's amazing. So you would think he'll have a really good year. When you look at it, because you're right, there's Jahan Dotson, and if Samuel is healthy all year, and I think, let's see. But Jahan Dotson, I think, was a good pickup. Whether or not he went too high or whatever, I think he's going to be a good player just based on what we saw in camp. Logan Thomas coming back, J.D. McKissic coming back. So there's a way for them to spread the ball around more than to have to force to McLaurin. But, I would think that a guy like Wentz, one thing it seems like he does, he starts to latch on to somebody that he really trusts. And you could even see it in the spring with Dotson at times where you trust where this guy is going to be. And I think with McLaurin, you're always going to trust what he can do. And I think the other thing he gives you is he's not a huge receiver. He's only, 6'6", but he plays strong. And he can win those contested catches. I think that will help a quarterback like Wentz as well. So I think those factors, I would certainly expect him, if he goes over 1,000, nobody should be surprised, right? That's what the expectations are now. But I think the offense will be better because he does have more help around him.
John Keim, ESPN, covers the Commanders. If he is, for the rest of his career, what he's been through 3 years, he'll go down as one of the best players on this team in his era of Redskins football team, Commanders football, right? But I wonder what the ceiling is. I still think there's more in the tank. I mean, you just kind of referenced this, but rather than scratching the surface, I want to dig a little deeper. Like, there is growth still. He's 26 years old. Maybe it's the Wentz addition that you and Danny were just referencing, but he has not caught 90 balls. I would think he could do that. His high watermark's 1,100 yards. I kind of view him as a, somewhere in that 11 to 15 range at wide receiver. Could he crack the top 10 before it's all said and done, in your opinion?
I think that's a hard one. I think he can. I think there may be some years where he's in that category, right? Because he does have that talent, and then it's a matter of what else is around you and if that quarterback play is at a certain level. Go back to his rookie year. He had that 100-yard game his first game. He should have had 300-yard games in the first 5 weeks, but the quarterback play was nowhere near the ability to help him do that. And it wasn't just because, sometimes there are missed throws on a play where he, it's down the middle, wide open by 10 yards, and it's overthrown by 10 yards. It's an easy 70-yard touchdown if you just hit him. And, plays like that were constantly missed. If he can get a consistent quarterback play, then sure, I think he could get to that point. And if he doesn't, that's a high, high, high point. It's a hard place to get to. But I think as long as he's always around, I think the beauty of McLaurin is he's always going to be around there, right? He's not going to drop off because it's not in his nature to, he's a hard guy. If you put money on a guy, who's not going to be complacent ever? It's that guy. He's got that, that Brian Mitchell kind of mentality where it's like you've always got to be working because, you were a third round pick and they thought you're going to be this. And, you always remember that, well, Ohio State didn't give me the scholarship right away, et cetera. So I think he'll always be in that mix. Whether or not he gets there, I think it's going to be dependent on how good is the quarterback play to help him get to that point.
John, what's your opinion on this? I've argued this for a little bit, kind of referencing back to my first question. I think this Rivera and the Marty's brain trust needed a win. They needed something to go right for them. Maybe organizationally they needed a win, too, if you want to kick it up to the C-suite when you start thinking about congressional testimony or subpoenas or investigations and the like. But this felt like, to your point about them understanding, I think, the gravity of this one. They just couldn't have anything negative come out at this point. So maybe they kind of went above and beyond. But just in terms of credibility, in terms of them calling their shot, having something work out, I think, was critical for them. Would love your thoughts there.
Oh, I 1,000% agree. In fact, I asked Rivera, we had a little gathering off to the side after today, and I because there were a lot of fans that you'd see on social media, if they don't sign this guy, I'm gone. I'm like, this, you know, and it's like all the things that have happened, and this is the one that would push them over the edge. So I did ask Rivera if he and David Aldridge asked him a couple questions along the lines of the importance to with getting McLaurin done amid all these investigations, et cetera. But with Rivera, I asked him about, you know, how much did you see what the fans had said? And he said, basically, he said, I heard them loud and clear. I think they understood the importance that if you want to build a certain way, this is the guy you want to build with. You can't let him get away. This is the guy who wants to be here and is the exact sort of person that you say you want to change the culture when you do it with people like McLaurin. So they knew. That's why I say all along there was, and Grant, you know this, like when you sometimes cover these negotiations, you're going to hear some things about a player that, like when Kirk Cousins was here, well, you knew he was gone based on what you hear here, like it's only nine games. You only proved himself for nine games, right? So you'd hear things like that when you knew, like, it's going to be a hard one to sign. This one, you never heard that. I never heard, like, you know, anything other than we want to keep him and we understand his importance here for the culture, as you said. And I do think you're right that they needed a win with all this stuff going on. You could not get to training camp with this still hanging over your head for fans, for the organization, for, and I know, like, players understand that it's a business. They do. So if they don't get him signed, I think players get, well, you know, it's a business. He'll go on somewhere. He'll make his money somewhere else. But you want to keep those guys because of what they mean just on and off the field, the example they set, et cetera. So, yeah, it's a big win for them, especially with all the stuff going on.
John, I want to sneak this in before we let you go. Baker Mayfield traded today by the Browns to the Panthers. The Panthers give up a conditional fifth-round draft pick, and Cleveland's picking up $10.5 million of Baker Mayfield's price tag. And I bring this up because with each of these quarterback moves, you'll remember going back to when they traded for Wentz, Mayfield's name was out there. There is nothing quite like what they gave up for Wentz this offseason. None of those deals look anything like taking on all of the money plus the draft picks. I guess it won't matter if he plays well, but it's not apples to apples. What's your thought on Mayfield to Carolina at that freight compared to Washington going all in for Wentz?
Well, I mean, it's obviously different situations because the Browns had no choice but to trade him. Once they got Deshaun Watson, they weren't going to get a good deal for Mayfield because everybody knew, like, well, if you don't trade him, you're going to have to cut him because you're not going to keep him. So they were never in an advantageous position after the Watson deal to get much for Baker Mayfield compared to a Carson Wentz. Now, whether or not Washington paid too much for him, how many other teams were really involved? It's, you know, the too much, we'll see how he plays over the next couple of years. But they were in a position where they needed to get a guy. They were very vocal about wanting to get a guy, and they wanted to get it done, I think, before free agency. So there was a timetable there where they wanted to be more aggressive getting it done. Whereas, again, with the Browns, like, I mean, I think I'm not sure they played any of this exactly right. So there you go.
John, you're the best, buddy. Always great to catch up with you, man. Be well.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys. Enjoy it.
That was John Keim of ESPN.com. At 4 o'clock, we are giving away WWE tickets. And at 5 o'clock, Greg McElroy stops by, one of the top college football analysts in the country, on what has been a zany last week or so with conference movement. What's college football going to look like in 10 years? We'll ask him coming up in a little under 2 hours. But next, right here on G&D, how good was Chet Holmgren last night in the Summer League? The highlights are a show. Plus, which Commander was named the most underrated player on the team by ESPN this week? We'll tell you right here on The Fan.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
All right, football fans, the NFL Draft is almost here, and the free Odyssey app brings you the latest coverage from the biggest sports radio stations across the country. Which players will help your team the most? Who will make a draft day trade? Will they be ready for week one? The local conversations about the team you love. All streaming free right here on the Odyssey app. A-U-D-A-C-Y. Download it today.
Grant and Danny welcoming you back on The Fan. Last night was about as bad as it's gotten for Nats fans this season. An 11-0 blowout loss. You got a position player pitching, which is always kind of fun for a minute and then a little bit embarrassing, Danny. But how about Kyle Schwarber going deep twice in that game? A little salt in the wound.
Every time you look up, it's either Scherzer making his first start back in the big leagues and he's shoved, of course, because he's Max Scherzer, which hurts. It's Bryce Harper winning an MVP and he was on his way to another before this thumb injury. And yes, Kyle Schwarber, the only reason, by the way, last year's Nationals had a winning month. They had one. And it was when Kyle Schwarber morphed into Babe Ruth, Ted Williams, and the rookie of the year or the kid that only hits homers from the children's book I read when I was young. He was the best player ever pretty much for a month. And the Nationals had their winning record that time. And since then, of course, it's been, and before then it was nothing but losing, and it's been nothing but losing since. But yeah, just a good dude that they were right about that hits a bunch of bombs.
I saw a tweet today that Schwarber has homered 51 times in the last 162 games he's played. So that dates back to the start, I'm sure, of last June and then through right now.
Man.
That Terry went on in Washington before he got traded to Boston. He obviously finished strong with the Red Sox all the way through, some big playoff swings for them. But then he ended up in Philadelphia where he's just mashed the NL leader right now with 25 bolts. Last night was tough. I was hoping that tomorrow, a day game in our time slot, we'll have a short show. I think we'll be on from 2 to 3:30. The Nats are going to play at 4 o'clock in Philly tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking it might be Cade Cavalli time.
Looks like it's not,
because
huh?
They need a starter. So maybe he gets called up and makes his major league debut. Here's the problem with that. It's not going to happen because Cavalli is scheduled to pitch in Rochester tonight. I reached out to someone to make sure. I'm like, hey, this isn't wrong, right? He's not getting skipped. And it sounds like he is planning on pitching tonight in Rochester, which means somebody not named Cade Cavalli will start for the big league club tomorrow.
Even though Paolo Espino pitched last night, it's still probably Paolo Espino somehow. You know what I mean? Like, that's just whatever that is. It's going to end up being him or somebody that you don't know about.
I would not doubt. Like, I would be more surprised at this point if it was something exciting where they called up a pitching prospect from the minors than if Paolo Espino just decided he was going to throw for the second time in 3 days.
Yeah, Davey was just like, listen, he didn't throw that many pitches. You know, Schwarber only took him deep twice. We could do something else. We'll do it again.
He got shelled. Let's run it back.
Run it back.
Did you see Chet last night in the Summer League?
I did. I actually tuned in. I normally don't watch Summer League. I like to check it out just a little bit to remind myself to take it easy. And I know it's Summer League. The usual caveats apply. The only thing you really learn in Summer League generally is if somebody can't play. Like, if you can't hack it in the Summer League, then it means you're not going to be okay on an NBA roster. I've seen guys tear up the Summer League and then be, you know, forgotten about a week or two into the season. But it's hard not to be tantalized by this unique-looking dude that you can't take your eyes off of, because he looks like a capital I, you know? Like, he's the skinniest dude ever. He's so narrow, and he's hitting step-back threes. He's dunking on people. He's affecting shots. I mean, he couldn't hack it in, you know, 30 years ago when you had real centers and big bruisers and guys would have knocked him into the 10th row, but you can't touch anybody now. And a guy like that can thrive and play. It was hard not to be enamored with the skill set of Chet Holmgren.
Hey, Chet Holmgren of the Thunder, who was drafted out of Gonzaga, he ended up coming off the board right at the top after the first overall pick. 23 points, 9 field goal attempts last night. 7 rebounds, 4 assists. He had 6 blocks, and he was 4 of 6 from 3. And the two moments, I think, that caught everyone's attention and really stunned everybody, he went behind the back. Again, this guy is 7 foot plus. And he goes behind the back and kind of a step back 3. That was nothing but net. And then he made a Dirk fall away jumper fading away to create a little bit of space right at the elbow that draw instant comparisons, and everyone was actually like putting the video side by side with Nowitzki. But I was just watching the highlights last night. blown away by this. I thought, I know it's early and this is aggressive, but to me, he's going to be the rookie of the year. I think that is his award to lose. The kid is special, man. And in today's NBA, with the lack of defense, with that size at the perimeter and his ability to shoot, take people off the dribble who are big trying to defend him, I think he's going to average 20-plus points as a rookie. He's going to be awesome.
Yeah, they're going to run everything through him, too. You know what I mean? Like, there's nobody right now in Oklahoma City where you say, oh, yeah, that guy needs all the touches. I mean, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is probably your best offensive option, and he can fly up and down the court. So it'll be those two guys, but he's going to get plenty of touches, plenty of opportunities. You know, the West is a buzzsaw, so I don't know how many games Oklahoma City's going to win, but I think that probably doesn't matter at this stage as they're still kind of building something. But yeah, I'm with you. He is the front runner to be Rookie of the Year, certainly.
I think he's going to be must-watch and just take the league by storm, too, because of how unique he looks. There's never been an NBA player that looks like him.
Yep. Again, it's that – he's got that I mean, he's kind of Durant-y in terms of build, right? I mean, that a seven-footer that can move around like that. He's not as athletic, not as, you know, not as gifted offensively as Durant was at this stage, but certainly can get a shot off on anybody. But it's defensively, GP, that I think is kind of the thing that makes him so curious and an oddity, right? As he's a great shot blocker. You know, listen, he's not quick enough to stay with like the Trae Youngs of the world or you know, any of these like super quick guards that dominate the game at this point, but he can hold his own. So like if you can switch, you could, it opens up great defense. So I think of the way Boston did it, right? Getting to the finals, basically being able to switch 1 through 5. So Al Horford gets stuck on your guard, it's no problem for a short part of a possession because we play great help defense. He's a great help defender. He's a guy that can be on the ball. He can block shots. He can handle, kind of get out and run. He's got a little Andre Kirilenko to his game, if you remember him, but he's better offensively than Kirilenko was. He's intriguing, dude. I couldn't change the channel. I couldn't take my eyes off the guy.
Double play coming up at 3:45. What's going on in our lives? Nothing to do with sports, and we're blitzing at 4. Remember, in 30 minutes at 4 o'clock, we've got those WWE tickets that could be yours. If you want to win those, make sure you are listening for the cue to call right at the top of next hour. I teased this, though, so I want to pay this off. ESPN.com did a piece on their NFL page yesterday where they labeled one player on every single team around the National Football League that they deemed to be underrated. And I was interested to see that the guy that they said is the most underrated player on the Commanders is Antonio Gibson. And the reason I found that so interesting was Antonio Gibson is a fantasy darling. And in social media, Twitter, fantasy football circles where everyone talks about volume and carries and touches and targets, and it's a whole industry now, Antonio Gibson is a household name and has been since the moment he got drafted because of his profile, wide receiver at Memphis, converted to running back. And that hasn't even netted as many targets or catches as it was supposed to. He averages 35 catches, basically, over the last two seasons for Washington. Having said that, though, I don't think he's underrated at all. I mean, the numbers, the advanced numbers on him actually show he's been inefficient with the amount of work Washington's given him. Now, he's coming off 1,000 yards. He did average barely over 4 yards per carry at 4.0+. Last two seasons, he's a 4.3 per carry guy, which is fine. Nothing to write home about. I think he's been good, very solid. I've been whelmed by him. I've actually been more impressed with him between the tackles as a thumper than I have with his pass catching or route running, which is what I thought he was going to bring to the table. And he's young. He's only 24, but at a position where when you get to 27, 28, that's when teams generally start trying to give someone else your carries. I'm just surprised they thought he was the most underrated player on the team, because I think he gets a lot of national attention.
Yeah, I think he's the most overrated player on the team, to be frank. So that surprises me. I mean, I'm a bit lower on him than you are. I really bought some of those advanced numbers where, you know, I forget exactly who did it, what those Pro Football Focus or somebody else showed, you know, the how well plays are blocked and then kind of the expected yards, and he was down at the very bottom of the league in terms of what, you know, your average running back would do with those similarly blocked plays. The offensive line did well last year, and he didn't. A pedestrian 4 yards a carry in this offense. And he dropped so many passes, especially early in the season. Fumbled a bunch of times. It's no coincidence they drafted a running back in the third round that can kind of do what they thought Antonio Gibson was going to do, right? They got that between the tackles thumper, not a home run hitter. They got a guy that kind of exhibits the skill set that they wanted Antonio Gibson to have. I don't think that's a coincidence. So to me, that's a surprising answer. The first name that came to mind for me was Cam Curl. That's the dude that everybody in that building will tell you, if asked, that guy needs a lot more credit. He's a baller. He's a badass. He's one of the best safeties in the sport, and nobody talks about him that way. That's the name that I thought of. I'm really, really surprised to hear that it was Gibson.
Well, he should be the answer, because I think that he's eventually going to play in the Pro Bowl. And my guess is that most fans around the country have never heard of him. And even if you're in Dallas or Philly or in New York and you see your team play him twice a year, you see him make enough plays that I bet you there's a respect and an understanding that he exists. But I don't know if around the league there's an appreciation for the quality that he brings on the back end. So I would agree with that. He's on the short list. There's a couple other guys. I still think Terry McLaurin is dramatically underrated, because I don't think around the NFL people understand how much he's done with how little he's worked with at the quarterback position. You know, it's funny when people see these charts, these graphics that are put out with who he's caught passes from, and they all go, oh my goodness, look at these QBs this dude has run routes for. There's a little bit more of a reverence and an appreciation for him being able to post the numbers he has in that circumstance, because a lot of guys get lost because of that. So I would have him on a short list. Gibson, I just think, overrated. I'm not sure if I would go there. You know, I don't know that anyone thinks he's one of the better backs in the league necessarily. Fantasy and reality are two different things. The fantasy community loves this guy. They just do. Mm-hmm. I don't get the sense that people that are like ranking running backs or talking about non-fantasy football are putting him on a big pedestal. But he has done nothing to this point to warrant a contract, let's say, where you're entering a part of your career after this season where you could start holding out and demanding money and demanding, because he's at a position where he's getting run into a wall 250 times a season, a new deal. And I wouldn't budge on that. I mean, he's done nothing to justify that. You mentioned the fumbles and some of the issues last year. But if you're not averaging over 4 yards a carry behind a pretty good offensive line that blocks things up well analytically, there's not a whole lot of argument for you to say that you need more money. So if, I can't imagine he plays that game next year, but they're already thinking about the future, to your point, with Brian Robinson coming in here. They've got J.D. McKissick, who they just re-signed. Mm-hmm. They could have let him go to Buffalo. He'd agreed to terms with the Bills. They brought him back before drafting a guy in the top three rounds, which I think does tell you a lot.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I don't know. You're right about the fantasy community. Gibson's a darling. I think they look at opportunity more than anything else, right? So, I mean, these are the same folks that would have told you Rudy Johnson years ago was a first-round fantasy draft pick, simply not because he was a great running back, because he was going to get the carries for a bad Cincinnati offense. But I do feel like you see it on the NFL shows here and there where you go, oh, he's part of the club, 1,000-yard rusher. And sort of nothing else matters there. You know, I think we're looking at all 258 carries, and we see some of the frustrating moments where if he just cut back, or if he just gotten away from that one guy, or if he just got going quicker, or was a little more patient, he could have had more. And I've been influenced heavily as well by Logan Paulson talking about him a little bit too. It's kind of opened my eyes to some things just about the nuances of the position that I, of course, have no idea about because I never played it. I never really played football beyond when I was 6 or 7 years old. Gibson to me is just, I don't know. I think the proof is A, who they drafted, and then B, just it's hard for me to unsee some of the just the pedestrian statistics that he put up given so many opportunities. I mean, this is a 300 touch guy last year, and he did kind of what any player, if he changed spots with anybody else, kind of would have done. You know, it just seems unremarkable to me, and I still feel like people talk about him in a way that he's a lot better than he is, but maybe
well,
that's my
own
bias.
Well, to that point, look, there were 7 guys in the NFL that rushed for 1,000 yards last season. So just by doing that, I think there's a faction of people that are just base level into the league where they'll go, who are the best running backs? And they look at yardage or whatever.
Yeah,
and they
like go, he's in the club.
Well, yeah, Antonio Gibson. He's good. Only 5 guys ran for more yards than him. He was 6th in rushing. Taylor ran for 1,800. Chubb went for 1,250. Mixon went for 1,205. Najee Harris went for 1,200 as a rookie. Dalvin Cook went for 1,150. And then it goes Gibson and Ezekiel Elliott at 1037 and 1002. That's the entire group, 7 running backs, who rushed for 1,000. But you go, well, is it because he was just that good, or is it opportunity, to use the word that you did? Only 3 guys ran the ball more often than he did. Mm-hmm. Joe Mixon, Najee Harris, and Jonathan Taylor. So, yeah, he put up 1,000 yards. That and $5 should get you a box of donuts walking out of FedEx Field on Landover Avenue or whatever that is, where they let me explain my joke now, where they hand out donuts for $5 after games. I mean, that's not exciting to me that you ran for 1,000 yards right on exactly 4 yards per carry. I mean, again, they're really good backs in this league who ran 215, 218, 220 times. And he had over 250 carries. If you start looking into percentages of carries that went for first downs or went for 5 yards, like those types of numbers, not nearly as kind to him. And that's before you even dive into some of the advanced numbers, as you said, on what a play was blocked for and what he actually gained. But I saw that, found that really interesting. We can take a deeper dive into the running back position and how they're going to divvy up carries this season in Washington's backfield a little bit later on this week. Next, our double play, what's going on in our lives, nothing to do with sports, and we are blitzing at the top of the hour at 4 when we give away those WWE tickets. We're Grant and Danny. This is The Fan. Where is Jimmy Garoppolo going to end up? It's another angle to this quarterback carousel, which seems to have just about stopped spinning. With Baker Mayfield to Carolina today, Browns trading Mayfield to the Panthers, where is left for Garoppolo? I mean, he's not going to Seattle, I wouldn't think. Makes no sense for a rebuilding team. He's going to stay in San Francisco, I bet. And if he does, do they start him over Trey Lance? That would be crazy in his second year after all they gave up for him.
So awkward. So weird. I mean, because if you believed initially the reports, it was Kyle Shanahan being like, yep, we're all in. It was always going to be Trey Lance. Then maybe it tells you, yeah, I don't know if Kyle Shanahan was in on Trey Lance, you know, because you
well,
think
Kyle Shanahan was in on Trey Lance. They gave up too much for Kyle Shanahan, who runs everything about their offense, to not have been in on Trey Lance.
You would think, but if he doesn't play for another year,
well, maybe you just didn't see what you wanted to. I mean, they've now watched him play for a year. He was definitely all in on him. They wouldn't have drafted him otherwise. To me, if they keep Garoppolo as QB1, then it just means that Trey Lance either they were wrong about or isn't ready yet, which we all knew this was a longer developmental phase than the line at the DMV. I mean, he had played a game of non-D1 football in the year before he was drafted because of COVID.
Yeah, pretty much, right? And it's been a long time, too, and he played at such a low level in terms of college football as it relates to the pros. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it's my own history with Kyle Shanahan. I feel like if he wanted to, he'd have been like, here's what I'm going to do. I'll construct a whole prism, this whole house of mirrors and cards to make sure that Trey Lance is successful, because that's the thing. We're just going to do that and make up a new offense that nobody's seen before and take the league by storm. I get the sense that, you know, I don't know. Maybe obviously they had to be on board to some degree to make the move that they did, but it must be buyer's remorse at this point if Jimmy Garoppolo starts.
Or maybe he'll start. I mean, maybe Lance will be the quarterback in week 1. The plan all along was never that he was going to start last year, and we haven't gotten to this year yet, and maybe they're going to have Garoppolo back him up. I guess that's possible. I mean, John Lynch is not calling the shots over Kyle Shanahan in San Francisco. That's just not a thing that's happening. Like, that's Kyle's operation, and he and York and Lynch work together. But I'll be curious to see in camp what those reps look like. Also, we don't even know about Garoppolo's health. Maybe they could hide behind that a little bit initially, where they say, well, he's not ready yet, or he's on PUP, or, you know, we need to ease him in with a pitch count. And then Lance gets the chance to be QB1. The problem there is if he doesn't get off to a fast start and you go to Garoppolo at any point in season – there's just going to be no way to view that in Lance's second season other than a bit of a nightmare to begin his career. Time for our double play. What's going on in our lives? Nothing to do with sports. Remember, 10 minutes from now, we're giving away a pair of tickets to go see Monday Night Raw when it comes to DC next month. Brought to you by GovSmart Intelligent IT Solutions for Government. Visit GovSmart.com.
Stranger Things Season 4 Part 2, GP. So I know this is a lot for you to deal with. You can just punch out here for a second because then there's too many episodes of quality
TV for
you to catch
up. Hold on, say that all again. I thought we did this a month ago.
They released Part 2 of Season 4. So it was you had a 7 episode arc that led up to, over the July 4th weekend, the finale of season four, right? So they released it in two parts, which, again, I know is just too much for you to process and to handle. You don't have to worry about it. Your Uncle Danny's over here. I watched it for you, so you don't have to.
Should we have just done it all in one part like everyone else does?
Well, they don't have to be everyone else because they've set the bar. The show is excellent. So season four, the first part of it, the first seven episodes, good job setting up your villain, good job with everything, but a lot of busy bodies, a lot of busy parts, left me feeling good but not great. The final two episodes landed the bleep out of the plane. The Duffer Brothers, who are the magnates behind the show, the creators, producers, director type guys, who have all these different ideas, they borrow so much from all the 80s and early 90s kind of classics, right? And they find a way to incorporate it into this really cool story with these amazing actor kids, really, that have come into their own. It was so damned good, setting the stage for the final season at some point. And who knows how long it's going to be, probably, you know, a couple years or whatever. But they did a really good job. And the final two episodes are way too long for my friend Grant Paulson to watch. Just know that each one is basically like watching a movie. And they landed the plane, I will say. They had all the different characters doing a bunch of different things in a bunch of different places. It got grandiose and huge, but they got it done, and I thought it was really, really, really good. This overall, season four, the best since season one, in my opinion, 8.5 carbohydrates out of 10.
Wow, Danny.
That's right.
Best since season one is best big season praise.
One. Mm-hmm.
Is someone's name still 11?
Absolutely.
I'm still out. Time for my double play. As you guys know, when your name is a number, it's not for me. That's kind of where I go with that. I like driving golf carts. That's pretty much all I got for you. I'm in Cape Charles, Virginia. It's a little beach town where my in-laws live. I spent the last couple of days here. I'm doing the show from their beach house. And everywhere we go in this little town, when we have to go pick something up or we go to lunch or, you know, go to the candy store for the kids or go get ice cream at Brown Dog, I drive a golf cart, and the kids pile into the golf cart. I just think that's awesome. I'd love to live in a place where I drive a golf cart all the time. Back to you, Danny.
I love golf carts. You were right about that. It is, there's something about that, like, quaint town, whatever that is, where you can just kind of tool along in a golf cart. I don't know why that's not more ubiquitous. Like, even in, like, my neighborhood right now, I can't get to a store if I just drove a golf cart, but I wish I could.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, it is just so quaint. It's so nice, and it doesn't feel like the same, you know, everyone's got to get their seatbelt on. We're getting in the car. No, we're just going to putter down the street with a couple of ice cream cones, you know, when we go to and fro. I'm all in. I love it.
Yeah, I think we got to normalize golf cart life. It's just a lot of fun, and kids love it, man. My kids want to, you know, they want to put the key in, and they want to, I'm going to sit in the front. Now I'm going to stand in the back, and it's a whole thing.
The
it's
backup
like,
sound
elevator
they love.
Buttons.
Yeah.
You ever go into an elevator when a kid didn't want to touch the button, you know? Golf carting, man.
Golf carting.
Everyone should do it in the summer more often. It is time for the Beltway Blitz, just a few minutes from right now. We'll be covering the Nats, the Wiz, and the Commanders all in one segment. Plus, we got those WWE tickets to give away. Top of the hour here on GND.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
All right, football fans, the NFL Draft is almost here, and the free Odyssey app brings you the latest coverage from the biggest sports radio stations across the country. Which players will help your team the most? Who will make a draft day trade? Will they be ready for week one? The local conversations about the team you love. All streaming free right here on the Odyssey app. AUDACY. Download it today.